I turned around and walked toward the square. Most of the mob had gone past us, so I was now in the outer fringes, the back lines of a crowd of perhaps 100, all moving at a trot, then a run, after the 3 retreating redshirts, who by this point had dragged their hostage all the way into the square as they tried to get away from that overwhelmingly superior force of rock-throwing, knife-waving attackers. My captor and I entered the square. The canal's edge was to my left, the square spread away from it to my right. War cries now sounded from that direction. I'm using the term war cry here to mean the unearthly scream that the first redshirt had uttered when he had come out of nowhere to protect me. Now we heard 10 of them at once. The first one, as I described, had simply paralyzed everyone. But in a short time we had learned to associate the sound with face-smashing, limb-twisting Vaelor experts. A battle line of redshirts had materialized on our right flank. They had been poised in the square, waiting for the first 3 to draw us into position. All heads turned toward, all bodies swerved away from them. Each of the redshirts had sent 1 or 2 members of the mob down to the pavement with bloody lacerations before we could even take in the image. The line of redshirts pivoted to link up with the first 3, who now released the man they'd been torturing. Beginning to understand that they were outflanked on the right, and that the square in general was enemy territory, unable to move left because of the canal edge, the mob turned back, hoping to withdraw the way they had come. But another salvo of war cries came from the rear as several redshirts vaulted up out of the canal. They had been hiding down there, clinging to the rugged canal wall like rock climbers, and we had unwittingly gone right past them. They sealed off the retreat. The only way out now for the mob was to squirt forward between the canal edge and the redshirts into the square, or jump down into the canal. As soon as a few had escaped via these routes, everyone wanted to do it, and it turned into a panic. The redshirts let them go. In a few moments, almost all of my attackers had simply disappeared. The 2 lines of redshirts joined up and contracted to form a sparse ring about 20 feet in diameter. They faced outwards. Their heads never stopped moving. In the middle of the ring were 3 people, the gun-toting leader, I, and a single redshirt who always moved so that he was between me and the muzzle of the gun. A red-shirted woman on the perimeter called out, "Fusil!" which was a ridiculously archaic Orth word meaning a long-barreled firearm. The redshirts to either side instantly turned their backs on her to look in other directions. Everyone else, though, did what came naturally, followed the woman's gaze to the top of a parked drummond on the edge of the square. A Geath had climbed up there with a long weapon and was training it in our direction. The woman who had called out Fusil skipped forward, raising her hands, and did a cartwheel that took her to the lid of a trash container. From there she sprang sideways, rolled, and came up near a drinking fountain on which she planted a foot to shove off and make a violent reversal of direction that took her toward a scraggly tree. She got a hand on that and swung round it, scampered to the top of a bench, disappeared into a little clot of pedestrians, reappeared a moment later sprinting directly toward the man with the gun, but in a moment had changed course again to duck behind a kiosk. In this manner she made rapid progress toward the gunman atop the drummond. He was hard-pressed to aim his weapon at her with all these sudden changes in course. If I'd been in his shoes, I couldn't have fired, even to save my own life, because her gymnastics were so fascinating to watch. A shot sounded, not from the man on the drummond, and not from the leader in the ring behind me. It came from somewhere else, hard to pin down because it echoed from the fronts of buildings all around the square. My knees buckled. 5 feet away from me, something unpleasant happened to the Geath leader. A redshirt had used this distraction as an opportunity to take him down and disarm him. The woman doing the gymnastics kept moving toward the gunman atop the drummond, who had frozen up and was looking all around trying to identify the source of the shot. A second shot sounded. The gun spun loose from the would-be sniper's hands and clattered to the pavement. He grabbed his hand and howled. The redshirt woman stopped with the gymnastics, dropped into a normal sprinting gait, and went straight to the fallen weapon.
"Fusil!"
called one of the other redshirts. He pointed across the canal. Again, the 2 flanking him spun about to look in other directions. It took the rest of us a moment to see what he had seen. Across the canal was a food cart, prudently abandoned by its owner. a three-wheeler had drawn up behind it, using it and its array of signs and fluttering banners to provide visual cover. One man was operating the three-wheeler's controls. Gnelliel Crade! Another was standing on his passenger platform. Ulassitar Crade! He was carrying a long weapon. He addressed himself to the sniper atop the Drummond, bellowing across the canal.
"The first shot was to make you freeze," he explained. "The second was to make you helpless. The third you're never going to know about. Show me your hands! Show me your hands!"
The Geith held up his hands, one of them bloody and misshapen.
"Run away!"
Yul howled and shouldered his rifle. The Geith avalanched down over the front of the Drummond, rolled around on the pavement for a few moments, then came up at a run.
"Raz, we gotta go,"
Yul called.
"The rest of you in the red shirts, whoever or whatever you are, you're welcome to come with. Maybe you want to be getting out of town as bad as we do."
There was a bridge over the canal at the square. Gnell zipped over it and came towards me. The circle of red shirts parted to let him in. He passed through the gap, eyeing them a little nervously, and pulled up alongside me. I wasn't moving too well. Yul bent down over me, grabbed my belt in his fist, just behind the small of my back, and heaved me aboard the three-wheeler like an unconscious rafter being pulled out of a river. It was extremely crowded now on this tiny vehicle. Gnell made a careful sweeping turn into the square and headed up a street. He was wearing earphones plugged into a G-jaw. Saman must be feeding him instructions. The red shirts followed us, jogging beside and behind the three-wheeler. Apparently they saw good sense in Yule's point that it was time to get out of town. Once it became clear which way we were going, they picked up the pace and threatened to outrun the three-wheeler, prompting Gnell to give it a little more throttle. Before long, they were sprinting. We covered a mile in a few minutes and came into a district of railway lines and warehouses that wasn't as crowded as the center of Old Masht. It was possible for full-sized vehicles to move about normally on the streets here. A pair of them came out of nowhere and nearly ran us down. Yule's and Gnell's fetches, driven by Cord and by Saman, respectively. As we later established, the red shirts numbered 25. We somehow got all of them onto the two fetches and the three-wheeler. I'd never seen people packed so tight. We had red shirts on the roof of Yule's fetch, elbows linked together to keep them from falling off. Cord took all of this pretty calmly, considering that she couldn't have known until just before they piled into the fetch that she was going to be transporting a dozen and a half Vlor experts in red t-shirts. As she drove us out of there, she kept looking over at me aghast.
"It's okay,"
I told her.
"They are avowed. They must have been evoked. I don't know what math they are from. Obviously one that specializes in Vlor. Maybe an offshoot of Ringing Veil or some such."
Behind me, an amused redshirt translated all of that into Orth and got a round of chuckles. I got embarrassed. Horribly mud on the head embarrassed. These people were from the Ringing Veil. I tried to turn back to look at them, but something impeded movement. Groping to explore, I discovered three hands, belonging to Veilers behind or beside me, pressing wads of blood-soaked fabric against my face and scalp. Lacerations. I hadn't been aware of them. It wasn't the strangers crammed into her fetch that so disturbed Cord. It was my face. During most of this, I'd been having the wrong emotions. At the very beginning, when the two Geiths had mugged me, I'd been scared. Appropriately. That's why I'd run away. Then I had convinced myself that I could handle this somehow. I could evade the mob in streets or canals. I could talk some sense into Laro, plead my case. They didn't really mean to kill me. This couldn't be happening. The cops would get here any minute. Next had come a sort of dazed acceptance of my fate. Then the Fraas and sewers of the Ringing Veil had arrived. Everything after that had been fascinating and sort of exhilarating, and I had surfed through it on some sort of chemical high. My body's reaction to injury and stress. A minute ago, I had greeted Cord with a big bloody hug as though nothing had happened. A few minutes into the drive, though, I fell apart. all of my injuries began sending pain to my brain, like soldiers sounding off at roll call. Whatever convenient substances my glands had been squirting into my bloodstream were withdrawn, cold turkey. It was as if a trap door had opened beneath me. Just like that, I became a shivering, weeping tangle of nerves, squirming and grunting in pain. 20 minutes' drive under Saman's direction took us to a site on the left bank of a big river that flowed from the mountains down into the old Masht fjord branch. It looked as though it might have been a broad sandbar in some earlier age, but had long ago been paved over and played host to a succession of industrial complexes, now in ruins. At one end of it was a recreational boat ramp and picnic ground with a couple of smelly latrines. We pulled in there and scared off some holidaymakers. I was carried out of Yule's fetch and laid out flat on a picnic table that they had covered with camping pads to make it soft, and tarps to protect the camping pads from whatever was leaking out of me. Yule opened his medical kit, which, like all of his other gear, was not store-bought but improvised from found objects. Into a big, heavy-gauge poly bag, he dumped white powder from a poly tube, salt and germicide. Then he filled it up with a couple of gallons of tap water and shook it for a minute, producing a sterilized, normal saline solution. He tucked the bag under his arm and squeezed it hard against his ribs, shooting out a jet of fluid that he aimed into my wounds to flush them out. Picking a wound, he would yank off the gauze and sluice it until I screamed, then give it another 30 seconds. Gunnell followed in his wake, working with something smelly. As he was using it on my split eyebrow, I realized it was a tube of glue, the same stuff you'd use to stick the handle back onto a broken teacup. Wounds too big to glue were bridged with glass fiber packing tape. At one point, a ringing veil sewer dug into me with a sewing needle and a length of fishing line from Gunnell's tackle box. Once a wound had been hit with glue, tape, or fishing line, someone in a red t-shirt would slap petroleum jelly on it and cover it with something white. A ringing veil frau, obviously a masseur, went over my whole body without so much as a by your leave, looking for broken bones and hemorrhages. If my spleen wasn't ruptured when he got to it, it was by the time he moved on to my liver. His verdict? Mild concussion, 3 cracked ribs, spiral fracture of 1 arm bone, 2 small broken bones in 1 hand, and I could expect to pee blood for a while. Enough time had gone by for me to be ashamed of how I had fallen apart during the drive, so I put a lot of effort into not screaming any more than was strictly necessary. For some reason, I was thinking of Leo. He had worshipped all things Vale since before he'd even been collected. He had tracked down every book at Sant Edhar that came from there, or that had been written by people who claimed to have visited the Vale or been beaten up by Valers. He'd have died of shame to know that I'd been less than totally immune to pain in the presence of these people. Conversations I was dying to be a part of were taking place just out of earshot. Once they finished gluing my head together, I could look about and see Saman talking to a senior fra from the Vale, and a sewer consoling Cord, who broke out crying whenever she turned her face in my direction. After a while, when it was decided I was going to live and so might be worth talking to, Fra Osa, the first among equals of the Veilers, came over to talk to me. With the exception of the seamstress, who was making long, tedious work of a rambling slash on my calf, the wound fixers raked up all their litter and drifted away. Yule went over and bear-hugged Cord and practically carried her over to the edge of the river, where she had a good, long, soaking cry.
"Yesterday we were evoked," said Fra Osa.
He was the first redshirt I had seen during the melee, the one who had covered me with his spear and perched on it one-legged. He was probably in his 5th decade.
"They said we should go to Tredegar. We consulted a globe and determined that the most efficient route was via Masht."
The Ringing Vale was 100 or so miles outside of Masht. From there, a great circle route across the ocean would take one almost to Tredegar. So this made sense as far as it went.
"Local people gave us transportation to Masht. We found it as you found it. Those of us who speak Flukish sought transport on a ship. We were approached by your magister."
"My magister?" I shouted. Then I saw the faintest trace of irony on Osa's face. He was half joking, but only half. Sark, he said.
He is well known to us. He comes to our apperts and speaks to us of his ideas.
Osa shrugged and made a gentle bobbling motion with his hands, which I thought was his way of telling me that they tried to weigh Sark's preaching fairly.
In any case, he recognized us in the street. He told us that a lone avowed was being pursued by a mob. We saw it as an emergence.
For a moment, I thought he was slipping into broken Fluckish, trying to pronounce emergency. Then I remembered some of the Vale lore that Leo had drummed into me over the years. During the time of the reconstitution, literally in the year zero, when the sites of the first new Maths were being surveyed so that the cornerstones of their clocks and minsters could be laid down, a team of freshly sworn in avowed had journeyed to a remote place in the desert to begin such a project, only to find themselves under siege by mistrustful locals. For the place they had been sent was covered with jumpweed plantations, and they had stumbled upon a shack where the weed was being boiled down to make a concentrated illegal drug. The avowed were unarmed. They had been pulled together from all over the world and so had little in common with one another. Most of them didn't even speak Orth, but it so happened that several of them were students of an ancient school of martial arts, which back in those days had no connection with the Mathic world, even if it had been developed in monastic settings. Anyway, they had never used their skills outside of a gym, but they now found themselves thrust into a position where they had to take action. Some of their number were killed. Some of the martial artists performed well, others froze up and did no better than those who had had no training at all. That sort of situation became known as an emergence. A few of the survivors went on to found the Ringing Vale Math. According to Leo, they spent almost as much time thinking about the concept of emergence as they did in physical training. The idea being that all the training in the world was of no use, maybe even worse than useless, if you did not know when to use it. And knowing when to use it was a lot harder than it sounded, because sometimes, if you waited too long to go into action, it was too late. And other times, if you did it too early, you only made matters worse.
The most salient feature of the enemy was its thoughtless aggression, Fra Osa said.
He reached into air and closed his hand as though grasping the wrist of an attacker who had tried to punch him. It was an eloquent gesture, which was convenient for me, since Fra Osa did not seem inclined to say more than that about the strategy they had used.
You reckoned, as long as they are in such a mood, let's really give them something to be aggressive about, I said, trying to draw him out a little more.
Fra Osa smiled and nodded.
So you grabbed that one person and started,
Here for once I broke off instead of telling the truth, which was that they had been torturing that geith. I didn't want to seem critical towards these people who had just risked their lives saving mine. Fra Osa just kept smiling and nodding.
It is a nerve pressure technique, he said. It seems to hurt a lot, but does no damage.
This raised all sorts of interesting questions. Was there really a difference between hurting and seeming to hurt? Was it permissible to torture someone if it didn't cause clinical injuries? But again, there were all sorts of reasons not to pursue such questions now.
Well, anyway, it worked, I said. The mob turned against you. You staged a false retreat and drew them into a trap. Then you made them panic.
More smiling and nodding.
Fra Osa simply was in no mood to wax eloquent about any of this.
And how long did you have in which to devise this plan? I asked him.
Not long enough.
I beg your pardon?
There is no time in an emergence to think up plans, much less to communicate them. Instead, I told the others that we would emulate Lord Frode's cavalry at Second Rushy Flats when they drew out Prince Terrazin's squadron. Except that the canal edge would substitute for the tall canes, and that little square would take the place of bloody breaks. As you can see, it does not take very much time to say these words.
I nodded as if I had some idea what he was talking about, which I didn't. I couldn't even guess which war he was alluding to, in what millennium.
What's with the red t-shirts?
I asked, though I already had my suspicions.
Fra Osa grinned ruefully. They were issued to us at Voco, he said, donated by a local Ark. I look forward to reaching Tredegar so that I can go back to the bolt and cord.
Speaking of which, he shook his head.
Your bolt, cord, and sphere are lost. Perhaps we could have gotten them back, but we departed in some haste.
Of course, I said. Not a big deal.
And it wasn't, in one sense. Fraz and Sewers lost theirs from time to time. New ones were issued. But losing mine in this way made me feel pretty bad. They had been with me for 10 years, and they had a lot of memories associated with them. They had been my last physical link to the Mathic world. Now that they were gone, I could be any old secular. Which might be safer. No one could yank them out from concealment and wave them around and try to lynch me. But it made me feel lonely. Saman went over and had a few words with Yul, who jumped up, fetched the rifle, grabbed it by the barrel, and after a few running steps, gave it a mighty heave. Spinning end over end, it flew about halfway across the river, then stabbed into the current and disappeared. About a minute later, two mobs full of moshed constables showed up and piled out of their wailing and flashing vehicles. Except for Fra Osa and the sewer who were sewing me together, all of the Ringing Veil of Out sat on the ground, feet tucked under them, and looked serene. The constables mostly gaped at them. How many thousands of spielies have been produced about the fictional exploits of these Fras and sewers? The cops couldn't begin to think of them as suspects. They saw them more as tourist attractions, zoo animals, movie stars. What's more, these Fras and sewers knew as much and knew how to exploit it. They showed us the meaning of posture and pretended to meditate. The cops ate it up. The boss cop had a long and, at first, tense conversation with Yul and Fra Osa. The sewer with the needle kept running that string through my flesh, and I gritted my teeth so hard I could hear them creaking. Finally, she tied it off and walked away without a word, without even a look. I had an upsight. I might have warm feelings for these people because they helped me and because I had seen way too many spielies about them before I'd been collected. The Veilers, however, had not been evoked because they were nice guys. Cord came over and stood with her hands in her pockets, taking inventory of my bandages.
See what a small percentage of my body they actually cover, I pointed out.
She was having none of it.
Our plan didn't work out so well, I offered.
She looked off to the side and sniffled, the last emotional aftershock of a long day.
Not your fault. How could we have known? I'm sorry to have put you through this. I don't understand how things could have gone so wrong.
She looked at me acutely and saw nothing, I guess, except for a stupid look on my face.
You don't have any idea what's going on, do you?
I guess not. Just that the military has been moving toward the pole.
A memory popped into my head, and a magister on the ship made some weird comment about the Warden of Heaven being cast out in wrath. Even as I was saying this, an old rattletrap coach was pulling in off the road. At its controls was Magister Sark. It was one of those freakish coincidences that made some people believe in spirits and psychic phenomena. I explained it away by supposing that my unconscious mind had seen the coach out of the corner of my eye a few moments before I'd consciously recognized him.
You still with me? Cord asked.
Yeah. Hey, what about Jessery? Is he okay?
We think so. We'll get you caught up.
We looked over at Yul, who had somehow managed to get the police captain laughing. Something had been decided between them. The official part of the conversation was over. The captain came over and made a few appreciative remarks about how banged up I was and what a tough guy I must be, then asked if I wanted to pursue it, to press charges. Absolutely lying through my teeth, I said no. By doing so, I apparently closed a deal. The particulars were never explained to me, but the gist of it was that all of us were free to go. The leaders of that mob would get off free except for injuries and insults already suffered. And these constables would dodge a mountain of paperwork. Paperwork that would have been 10 times as bad as what they were used to, simply because many of those concerned were avowed and hence of tricky legal status. Magister Sark had not been idle during all of these other goings-on. The coach belonged to his Kelks and Masht. It was painted all over with triangle iconography. It was large enough to transport all of the Veilers, Some other member of his Kelks had volunteered to drive them south to a bigger city, less chaotic than Masht at the moment, whence they could arrange transport to Tredegar. This driver, he explained, was on his way, but because of the difficult conditions in town, we might have to wait for a little while. The Magister glanced at me as he was explaining these things, and for some reason I felt a thrill of resentment. I did not like being indebted to him, and did not relish the prospect of having to sit gratefully through another sales pitch for his faith while we waited for the driver to show up. But it seemed he was more interested in checking my status than starting a conversation. And as soon as he stopped looking my way, I felt ashamed of the way I had reacted. Was there really that much of a difference between the Kelk's notion of having one story related to the magistrate and the Veiler's concept of emergence? They seemed to produce very similar behavior. I owed my life to the fact that Sark and Ossa had been of one mind earlier today in Masht. I was on my feet by now. I limped over to him, held up my hand, and thanked him. He shook my hand firmly and said nothing. "The condemned man had a good yarn to spin for the magistrate today," I said. I guess I was trying to humor him. His face darkened.
"But he could not tell it without speaking too of the ones who behaved evilly. Yes, it is the case that, thanks to the spirit of the innocent, some good was achieved. But I can scarcely believe that the magistrate's ultimate judgment of this world was much shifted, either way, by what he heard from the condemned man today."
Not for the first time, I was astonished by Magister Sark's ability to be intelligent and wise while spouting prehistoric nonsense. "For your own part, anyway," I pointed out, "it seems you chose in a way that reflects well on you and your world."
"The innocent moved me," he insisted. "Give all credit to her."
"I give you my personal thanks," I said, "and ask you to relay it to the innocent the next time you hear from her." He shook his head in exasperation, then finally chuckled, though such a grim fellow was he that his chuckle was something between a gag and a cough.
"You don't understand at all."
"Fair enough," I said. "I am in no shape for dialogue right now, but perhaps some other time I can try to explain to you how I see all of these matters." His reaction was noncommittal, but he understood that the conversation was over. He wandered away. I collected some blank paper from Yule's fetch and began to scribble out notes to my friends at the Convox. Magister Sark got into a long conversation with Yule and Cord, interrupted from time to time by Ganeliel Crade, who, of course, belonged to a completely different faith, and who paced back and forth at a distance, fuming, then darted in from time to time to dispute some fine point of deology. A mob swung through, dropped off the driver who would take the Veilers south, and picked up Magister Sark. The Veilers began to find seats aboard the coach. Fra Ossa was the last to board. I handed him a stack of notes. "For my friends at Tredegar," I explained, "if you would not mind bearing them." He bowed. "You've already done me plenty of favors, so it is okay to say no," I went on.
"You did us a favor," he countered, "by creating an emergence nested within the larger emergence and giving us an opportunity to train."
I said nothing. I was wondering what he meant by the larger emergence, and reckoned he must be talking about the cousins. He was sifting through the letters I had given him.
"You have many friends at the Convox," he remarked,
and looked up at me quizzically. This was probably an indirect way of asking, "What the heck are you doing?" But I ignored it. "The thick one there is for a girl named Ayla. The others are for some other fras and sirs of mine."
"Ah," exclaimed Fra Ossa, holding one up. "You know the famous Jesri."
I didn't even want to think about what was implied by Jesri's being famous, so I glided past it and directed his attention to the last letter in the stack.
"Leo,"
I said.
"Fra Leo is a student of Veil lore."
"Ah,"
he exclaimed, as if Leo were unique, as if the world, for thousands of years at any given moment, had not contained millions of Vlor students. Mostly self-taught, but it is important to him. If this letter were handed to him by even the most junior member of the Ringing Veil Math, it would be the greatest honor of his life. Don't tell him I said that. Fra Osa bowed again.
I shall comply with all of your instructions.
He put his foot on the coach's running board.
Here I say farewell, unless...
And he looked between me and the coach. I fell for it hard. I imagined the long ride on the coach full of authentic Ringing Veil of Out, maybe a night or two in a room at a casino down south, a journey, safe and well organized, to Tredegar, reunion with my friends there. If these people could somehow get their hands on a plane, it could even happen in a day. I imagined all of that long and hard enough to savor it, to look forward to it. But I knew it was all a daydream, that I had to pull back, that the longer I kept on this way, the harder it was going to be.
I want to climb on board that thing and go to Tredegar with you like that water wants to find the ocean,
I said, gesturing to the river. But to quit in the middle, just because I'm beat up and homesick and scared, seems wrong.
Fra Jad, he's the millenarian who sent me, would never understand.
This was the first thing that had happened all day that startled Fra Osa.
A thousander,
he repeated.
Yes.
Then you had best finish the task.
That's kind of what I'm thinking.
He bowed one more time, more deeply than before. Then he turned his back on me and climbed into the coach. The cops followed them out. I went to the latrine and peed blood and boarded Yule's Fetch. Saman was in there, too. We pulled onto the main road and turned south. I slept.
They said I only slept for half an hour, but it felt much longer. When I woke up, I crawled into the back of the Fetch, where it was darker, and Saman showed me a spieli on his jija. Saman was the only member of the crew who didn't make remarks or ask questions about my injuries and emotional state. This might make it sound like he was insensitive. Frankly, though, I could have done with a lot less sensitivity by that point in the day.
There is not a lot of explanatory content connected to this data because of the way in which it was obtained,
he warned as he was queuing it up. The image quality was, as usual, terrible. It took me a minute even to be sure that it had been shot in color. Everything was either solid black, space and shadows, or blinding white, anything with sun shining on it. As I slowly came to realize, it had been made by aiming a handheld spielicaptor out a dirty window.
Outgassing,
Saman said, which meant little to me. He went on to explain that the materials used to build the space capsule had, in the vacuum of space, let go of vaporous byproducts that had congealed on the spacecraft windows.
Huh, you'd think they would have solved that problem, I said.
They built it in a rush,
he answered. A perfect circle, centered in a perfect equilateral triangle, dominated the view.
It's the back end of the alien ship, Saman explained, the pusher plate on the rear. They always kept it oriented toward the capsule. Think about it.
After a few moments, I tried.
The cousins, couldn't be sure that our space capsule wasn't carrying a nuclear warhead, so they kept the nuke-proof part of their ship aimed towards it.
That's part of it,
Saman said, and gave me a wicked grin, egging me on.
They could spit one of their own nukes out the back of that thing and blow up the space capsule anytime they felt like it.
You got it. Also, we can't get a good look at their ship from this angle. No way to gather military intelligence.
Where's the hole that the nukes come out of? I asked.
Don't bother looking. You can't see it. It's tiny compared to the scale of the plate. It's closed by a shutter when it's not in use. You won't be able to see it until it opens.
It's going to open?
Maybe it's better if we just watch the spieli.
Saman reached in and turned up the volume a bit. The soundtrack was a roar of ambient noise, whooshes, hums, buzzes, and drones at many different pitches. There was the occasional human word or phrase shouted over the roar, but people spoke rarely, and when they did, it tended to be in terse military jargon.
"Bogey," someone said. 2 o'clock.
The image veered and zoomed, the big triangle expanding until its edge had become a straight division separating white from black. In the black part, a gray blob was discernible, just a mess of pixels a few shades brighter than black. But it got brighter and bigger.
"Incoming,"
someone confirmed. The murk of noise took on new overtones. People were conversing. I thought I heard the cadences of an orth sentence.
"Prepare for egress,"
someone commanded, in a voice that meant business. For the first time, the spelecaptor turned away from the window and refocused to show the interior of the space capsule. This view was shockingly crisp, clear, and colorful after the endless dreary shot of the pusher plate. Several people were floating around in a confined space. Some were strapped into chairs before consoles. Some were gripping handles, the better to keep their faces pressed against windows. One of these was definitely Jezri. In the middle of the capsule was the big man with the hairdo. He didn't look good. Weightlessness had made his hair go funny. His face was swollen and greenish. I could tell he was nauseated. He looked tired and uncaring, maybe from anti-nausea drugs. His impressive clothes were gone, revealing all sorts of things about his physique that no one except for his doctor really needed to know. A couple of people were striving to fit him into an outlandish garment consisting of a network of tubes and a matrix of stretchy fabric. It seemed that this project had been going on for a while, but just now they threw it into high gear, and one of the others pushed himself away from a window and flew over to help jerk the thing on. The Warden of Heaven, I didn't know for a fact that this was he, but it seemed unmistakable, woke up enough to become indignant. He glared at the camera and lifted a finger. One of his aides drifted into position to block the view and said, "Please give his serenity some serenity," cracked Jezri off camera. Testy words were exchanged. The authoritative voice commanded them to shut up. The argument was replaced by technical conversation pertaining to the suit that they were building around the Warden of Heaven's body. One of the console watchers called out updates on the approach of the bogey. Jezri said, "You're about to become the first person ever to converse with aliens. What is your plan?" The Warden of Heaven made some brief and indistinct response. He was farther from the microphone, he wasn't feeling well, and he had seen enough of Jezri by this point to know that the conversation wasn't going to end well. The spelecaptor swung round to point at the Warden again. They had finished putting the tube garment around his body and were building a spacesuit over that, one limb at a time. Off camera, Jezri answered, "How do you know that the geometers are even going to recognize that concept?" Another muffled, noncommittal response from the Warden, who, to be fair, couldn't talk well because they were mounting a headset on him. "Geometers?" I asked.
"That's what people at the Convox have been calling the aliens, apparently," Saman said.
"I would try to go in there with a mental checklist of basic observations I wanted to achieve," Jezri went on. "For example, do they take any precautions against infection? It would be quite significant if they were afraid of our germs, or if they weren't." The Warden of Heaven deflected Jesri's suggestion with a humorous remark that his aides thought was funny. "You ever look at bugs under a lens?" Jezri tried. "That'd be good preparation for this. They look so different from anything we normally experience that it's easy to be kind of stunned and bewildered by their appearance at first. But if you can get past that emotional reaction, you can see how they work. How do they transmit their weight to the ground? Count the orifices, look for symmetries, observe periodicities, by which I mean how often do they breathe. From that, we can make inferences about their metabolism." One of the aides cut Jezri short by telling him it was time to pray. The suit was all on now except for the helmet. The Warden's head, unrecognizable under the earphones, the mic, the heads-up goggles, poked up out of a huge, rigid carapace. He held hands with his aides as best as he could through the bulky gloves. They closed their eyes and said something in unison. A loud metallic pop crunch interrupted them.
Contact, someone called. We have been grappled by a remote manipulator.
The Speely captor swung past a crew member checking his watch and aimed back out the dirty window to focus on the bogey. This was a skeletal craft, altogether mechanical. No pressurized compartments where a cousin might ride along. Just a frame with half a dozen robot arms of various sizes and thruster nozzles, spotlights, and dish antennas pointed every which way. One of its arms had reached out and grabbed an antenna bracket on the outside of the capsule. Things happened fast now. The helmet had already been clamped down over the Warden of Heaven's head, and crew members had shooed away the aids and were manipulating the suit's controls. Through the bubble, the Warden's eyes could be seen moving back and forth uncertainly, responding to inscrutable hisses and creaks from the suit as its systems came alive. His lips moved and he nodded and gave thumbs-up signs as communications were tested. They pushed him through a pressure hatch at one end of the capsule, closed it behind him, and turned a wheel to dog it shut. He was in the airlock. "Why is he going alone?" I asked.
"Supposedly that's how the cousins, excuse me, the geometers wanted it," Saman said. "Send one," they said.
"So we sent him?"
Saman shrugged. "But that's part of the geometer's strategy, isn't it? If we were allowed to send a whole delegation, we could hedge our bets. But if the whole planet is allowed to send only one representative, whom do we pick? That tells them a lot."
"Yeah, but why?" Saman cut me off with an even more exaggerated shrug.
"You seriously expect me to be able to explain why the secular power makes the decisions it makes?"
"Okay. Sorry. Never mind." Hisses and clanks and terse utterances from the crew signaled the opening of the airlock's outer door. A small arm unfolded itself from the geometer's robot probe and reached toward the ship, out of view of this window. When it drew back, a few moments later, it brought the Warden of Heaven with it. The arm's steely hand had gripped a metal bracket that projected from the suit's round shoulder, a lifting point. The geometers understood our engineering and knew a bracket for a bracket. The bogey disengaged from the capsule and fired a puff of gas to get itself drifting away. Then, after a few seconds, ignited larger thrusters that accelerated it toward the icosahedron. The Warden of Heaven waved back at us.
"Everything is okay,"
he announced over the wireless. Then his voice was replaced by a harsh buzzing tone. A crew member turned it down.
"They're jamming us," he announced. "His serenity is on his own."
"No," said an aide. "God is with him." The Speely captor zoomed in on the Warden, being drawn backwards towards the icosahedron. He was getting harder to see, even at maximum zoom, but it looked like he was gesticulating, tapping his helmet and throwing up his hands in confusion.
"Okay, we get it," Jessery said. "You can't hear."
"I'm worried about his pulse, way too high for a man his age," said a crew member.
"You've still got telemetry?" Jessery asked.
"Just barely. They jammed Vox first. Now they are attacking the other channels." "Nope, lost it. Bye-bye."
"The geometers are some kind of military hard asses," Saman said, perhaps unnecessarily.
The video went on with little further commentary until the robot probe and the Warden had shrunk to a tiny cluster of gray pixels. Then it cut out and went to black. Saman paused it.
"In the original, what follows is 4 hours of basically nothing," he said. "They just sit there and wait. Your friend Jessery baits the Warden's toadies into a philosophical debate and crushes them. After that, no one wants to talk. There is only one event of note, which is that after about 1 hour, the jamming stops."
"Really? So they can talk to the Warden again?"
"I didn't say that. The jamming signals are turned off, but they can't get any data from the Warden's spacesuit. Most likely, what it means is that the suit had been shut down."
"Because something happened to the Warden of Heaven, or—"
"Most people think he got out of the suit. Since it was no longer necessary, it was turned off to conserve power."
"That implies—"
"That the Hedron, as people are calling it, has an atmosphere we can breathe, yes," Saman said. "Or that the Warden was dead on arrival."
"The Warden of Heaven's dead?" Saman started the Speely playing again. The time code in the corner had jumped forward a few hours.
"New signal from the Hadron," announced a tired crew member. "Repetitive pulses, microwaves, high power. I'd say they are illuminating us with radar."
"Like they don't already know where we are," someone scoffed.
"Cut the chatter,"
ordered the voice I'd come to think of as the captain's.
"Do you think they are acquiring us?"
"As in acquiring a target for a weapons launch," Saman translated.
"Well, it's definitely that kind of a narrow beam signal," said the other. "But steady, not homing in."
"Activity on the base plate," Jessery called. "Dead center." The image once again wheeled to the huge triangle that dominated the view. Then it zoomed. A dark mote was visible in the center. As the zoom went on, this grew and resolved itself as a circular pore.
"Give us some distance,"
the captain ordered.
"Brace for emergency acceleration. 3, 2, 1, now," said another voice.
And then everything went out of whack for a minute. People and stuff flew around. Loud clunks and hisses sounded. Everything that was loose ended up plastered against the bulkhead closest to the icosahedron as the capsule accelerated away from it. The woman holding the spelecaptor did her share of gasping and cursing. But soon enough, she got it pointed back out the window.
"Something is coming out of that port," Jessery announced.
And once again we were treated to a long, veering zoom-in. But this time, the hull wasn't crisp-edged and black. It was pinkish, its boundaries ill-defined. The pink part was moving. It separated itself from the base of the icosahedron. It had been cast off. It was adrift in space. The hull irised shut behind it.
"That doesn't look like a nuke," someone said.
"Understatement of the year," Saman muttered.
"Move in on it. Brace for acceleration. 3, 2, 1, now."
There was another messy scene as the capsule reversed its direction and began heading back toward the icosahedron. Yet again we had to wait as the indefatigable woman with the spelecaptor made her way back to that tiny, filthy window and reacquired the shot. She gasped. So did I.
"What is it?"
asked one of the voices. They couldn't see what she, what I, could see, because they weren't peering at it through magnifying optics.
"It's him," said the woman holding the spelecaptor. "It's the Warden of Heaven."
She refrained from mentioning one important detail, which was that he was stark naked.
"They threw the Warden of Heaven out the airlock."
Saman stopped it.
"That has become the hip catchphrase of the moment," he told me. "Technically, though, it's not an airlock. It's the port where they spit out the little nukes."
The warden at this point was still small and poorly resolved, but he had been getting bigger, and I had been steeling myself for what he would look like close up.
"I can keep playing it if you want,"
Saman offered, none too enthusiastically.
"Or..."
"I've seen enough gore for one day, thanks," I said.
"Don't you explode or something?"
"There was a little bit of that. By the time they got him back into the capsule, well, it was a mess."
"So the geometers just executed him?"
"This is not known. He might have died of natural causes. They found a burst aneurysm on autopsy."
"I imagine they found a lot of burst stuff."
"Ew,"
Cord said from up front.
"Exactly. So it's hard to say whether it blew before or after he was thrown out."
"Have the geometers sent out any communications since this happened?"
"We'd have no way of knowing that. This spiele was leaked. Other than that, the powers that be have managed to control information pretty effectively."
"Is everyone looking at this spiele? Does the whole world know about it?"
"The powers that be have shut down most of the reticulum in order to control propagation of this spiele," Saman said. "So only a few people have seen it. Most people, if they've heard anything, have only heard rumors."
"That's almost worse than facts," I said, and told him about Magister Sark. "When did this happen?" I asked.
"While we were going over the pole," he said. "The capsule landed a day later with the warden's remains on board. Meanwhile, the military had begun moving toward the poles, as you found out."
"Which makes no sense to me," I mentioned.
I am told that the Hedron is in an orbit that confines its ground track to a belt around the equator.
Yes, and so if you go to the far north or south, you can get out from under it and may be out of reach of its weapons. Depends on what kind of weapons they are. But the part that doesn't make sense to me is that the geometers could change their orbit any time they wanted to. The first few months they were here, they were in a polar orbit, remember?
Yes, of course I remember,
Saman said. Then they changed and...
And what? Saman asked, after a while, since I'd gone silent.
And I saw... Ayla and I saw light from the nukes that they fired to make that change in their orbit. Plane change maneuvers are expensive. For them to change back to a polar orbit now, where they could shoot down on our military forces at the poles, they'd have to fire that many nukes again. I looked at Saman. They're out of fuel.
You mean out of nukes?
Yeah. Nuclear bombs are the fuel that makes the ship go. They can only store so many of them. When they run low, they have to...
To go get more, Saman said.
Which means zeroing in on a technically advanced civilization and raiding them, pillaging their stockpile of nuclear material, which in our case means
Edhar, Rambalf, and Tredegar, Saman said.
That was the message they were sending on the night that the lasers shone down, I said. The night I was evoked. The night Fra Orlo walked down off of Bly's Butte, Cord put in, and headed for Ekba.
Part 8. Orathena.
The drive south went fast. We did it in 4 days and 3 nights. We were almost out of money, so we camped. Yul cooked our breakfasts and suppers. We saved our money for fuel and for lunch, passing through the mass-produced restaurants and fueling stations like ghosts. During the first day or so, the landscape was dominated by endless tracts of fuel trees, relieved by small cities surrounding the plants where they were shredded and cooked to produce liquid fuel. Then we had 2 days of the most densely populated territory I had ever seen. The landscape was indistinguishable from that of the continent where we had started, the same signs and stores everywhere. The cities were so close that their faubourgs touched one another, and we never saw any open countryside, just pulsed along the highway network from one traffic jam to the next. I saw several consents. They were always in the distance, for they tended to be built on hilltops or in ancient city centers that great highways swerved to avoid. One of these, by coincidence, happened to be Sant Rambalf. It was built on an elevated mass of igneous rock several miles wide. I thought about harrowing. When Alwash had used that word on me back on the ship, I had thought it was funny. But after what had happened in Masht, I really did feel harrowed. Not in the sense of a weed that had been pulled out and burned, but in the sense of what was left after the harrowing had been finished. A plant. Young, weak, survival still uncertain, but standing alone and alive, with nothing around it that might interfere with its growth or that could protect it from whatever blasts came its way tomorrow. Late on the third day, the landscape began to open up and to smell of something other, more ancient, than tires and fuel. We camped under trees and packed away our warm clothes. Breakfast, the fourth day, was made from things Cord and Yul had purchased from farmers. We drove into a landscape that had been settled and cultivated since the days of the Bayesian Empire. Its population had, of course, waxed and waned countless times since then. Lately, it had waned. The faubourgs and then the cities had withered, leaving what I thought of as the intransigent strongholds of civilization, wealthy people's villas, maths, monasteries, arks, expensive restaurants, souvens, resorts, retreat centers, hospitals, governmental installations. Little stood between these, save open country and surprisingly primitive agriculture. Tufts of scrawny, garishly colored businesses sprouted at road junctions, just to keep the riffraff like us moving. But most of the buildings were stone or mud, with slate or tile roofs. The landscape became more sere and open as we moved along. The roads shed lanes, then insensibly narrowed, grew rougher and more torturous, until without having noticed any sudden transitions, we found ourselves driving on endless one-lane tracks and stopping to avoid flocks of livestock, so tough and emaciated they looked like jerky on the hoof. Late on the fourth day, we came over a little rise and beheld in the distance a naked mountain. Mountains, for me, had always borne dark green pelts, shaggy with mist. But this one looked as though acid had been poured on it and burned off everything alive. It had the same structure of ridges and cols as the mountains I was used to, but it was as bald as the head of a ringing veil of out. The pink-orange light of the setting sun made it glow like flesh in candlelight. I was so taken by its appearance that I stared at it for quite a while before I realized that there was nothing behind it. A few more such mountains rose beyond it in the distance, but they rose from a flat and featureless geometric plain, dark gray. An ocean. That night, we camped on a beach beside the Sea of Seas. The next morning, we drove the vehicles down a ramp onto a ferry that took us to the island of Ekba.
Semantic faculties. Factions within the Mathic world in the years following the reconstitution, generally claiming descent from Halicarn, so named because they believed that symbols could bear actual semantic content. The idea is traceable to Protus and to Hylea before him. Compare syntactic faculties. The Dictionary, 4th edition, AR 3000.
The light through the tent cloth roused. The surf on the beach lulled, and like a log rolling up and down in the breakers, I had rocked any number of times between sleeping and waking, as I nursed a vague and uneventful dream about the geometers. Some part of my mind had become obsessed with remote manipulator arms on the probe that they had sent out to fetch the Warden of Heaven, and had been consuming vast dark energies dwelling on them, sharpening and embellishing my memories, building them up into a hybrid of seen and imagined, theorics and art, that encoded all sorts of weird ideas and fears and hopes. I fended off wakefulness as long as I could, since that would lose me the dream, and I lay there, half-conscious, waiting for something to happen, willing the dream to move ahead, to reveal something. But I only grew more restless, for nothing occurred but what sprang from my own thinking. Endlessly deeper study of the joints, bones, bearings, and actuators of those arms, which in my imagination had become as complex as my own arms and hands, and styled with the same organic curves as the parts of our clock that Cord used to make for Saman. The only new thing that developed in that dreaming was that, at the very end, I turned my attention from the arms to the imaging devices that I guessed must be present on the bodies of those probes. But those lenses, supposing they were there, were guarded by clusters of spotlights. And when I tried to stare into them and meet the geometer's gaze, all I could see was explosions of glare, held apart by utter blackness. Frustration succeeded in waking me up where daylight, the smell of cooking food, and the other's conversation had failed. I could not move matters forward, save by waking up and doing something. Ekba was beautiful. In a hot and harsh way. It had taken us a day simply to erect defenses against sun and heat. We had found an east-facing cove north of a precipitous rocky headland that afforded us shade for much of the day, and Yule had showed us ways to anchor stakes deep in the sand, which enabled us to put up tarps that blocked the sun of late afternoon. The only time we really got blasted with it was first thing in the morning, before the heat got too bad. A smaller island half a mile offshore broke and diffracted incoming surf, so waves here were small but unpredictable. The cove was too shallow and rockbound to be of any use to any but the smallest boats, so it had never, as far as we could tell, been settled or used for anything.
We kept expecting someone to rush up, gaudy with insignias, and eject us, but it didn't happen. The place was not private property. It was not a park. It was simply there. Ekba's only real settlement, other than the math at Orathena, enveloped the ferry terminal 5 miles away in a straight line, 15 by the road that traversed the island's shore. A desalination plant, powered by the sun, made and sold water there. Yule had filled a couple of musty-smelling military surplus water bladders when we had arrived. Between that and the food we'd bought from farmers on the mainland, we wouldn't really have to make another supply run for a week. The day after we had made the camp and pitched the tarps had been, by unspoken, unanimous agreement, a time to rest. Beat-up books had appeared from bottoms of bags. Someone was always snoring. Someone always swimming. I borrowed a pair of long-nosed pliers from Cord and yanked my stitches out, then sat in the surf up to my neck until the wounds went numb. There is more I could, but won't, say about healing. Watching my body marshal its forces of regeneration was fascinating at the time and probably accounted for the weird dreams I had been having about the metallic limbs and crystal organs of the alien probe. There was the temptation to ponder and philosophize about the relationship between mind and body, but the lorite in me said it would be a waste of time. More efficient to find a library and read what better thinkers had written on it. During the following 2 days, the members of our party had one by one begun to show some gumption and to explore. Late yesterday, Yule had shattered the calm of the place by starting the engine of Cord's fetch, and some of us had gone for a dawdling 2-hour circumnavigation of the island. The location of the volcano was, of course, no secret. There was hardly a place from which it couldn't be seen. It was steep, which, as Fra Heligastrim had taught me, meant that it was dangerous. Some volcanoes produced runny lava that spread out quickly. These were lens-shaped and safe, provided you could walk faster than the lava. Others made thick lava that moved slowly and built steep slopes. These were dangerous because pent-up pressure had no outlet except for explosions. This island was the last stop on a ferry route that ran generally south-southeast from the mainland, so we had steamed into it from the north. The terminal and town were built around the island's only surviving harbor, a bight chomped out of the northwest limb of the approximately round island. Our camp was in the northeast, in one of a series of closely spaced coves separated by fingers of hardened magma that had reached down from the caldera many centuries before Ekba had been settled. So all of our views, during those first few days, had been of the north face of the volcano, which looked regular and graceful, even if Heligastrim's voice was in my ear telling me it was dangerously steep. Yesterday's drive had taken us clockwise around the island, passing down its eastern shore, and after a few miles, we had suddenly come in view of its south slope, which had exploded and collapsed in -2621, burying the Temple of Orathena, and filling in and obliterating a harbor on the island's southeastern coast into which the early physiologers, followers of Canoas from all round the Sea of Seas, had once voyaged in their galleys and sailing ships. Anyone could see at a glance that it was the result of an explosion. The ash and rubble sloped straight from summit to sea. So slow had Ekba been to recover that the road, even now, faltered as it came up onto the rubble fan and became an informal dirt track for several miles. There were no signs, no buildings or improvements. At one point, though, as we had slowly rounded the island's southeastern curve and had come to a place where we could look straight up into the yawning rupture in the volcano's cone, we had seen a separate track, teed into the coastal road, that ran straight uphill for some distance, then veered off into the first of a series of switchbacks. These ascended a bare slope whose skyline was reinforced by a dark wall. We hadn't needed Saman's satellite imagery to know that this was the math that had been a building there since 3000. Halfway between us and it, at the beginning of the switchbacks, a few low buildings struggled to keep their roofs above the drifting ash. We had gone up there and found several of out running a sort of checkpoint and souvenir stand. They had all worn bolts and cords openly. We had told them no lies, but behaved as if we were tourists. They had been pleased to sell us things, soap made with volcanic ash, but had let us know we could not drive any farther up the road. Later, as we had paused in town to pick up supplies, I had again seen Bolted and Corded Avowed walking around openly. They had not seemed like hierarchs. This had been, then, a violation of the discipline, as was letting Avowed run a souvenir stand. But, too, it let us know that relations between Avowed and extras were much friendlier here than, say, in Masht. I had badly wanted to approach those Avowed and ask them if they knew of Orlo, but had checked myself, reasoning that they would still be here tomorrow, and it was better to sleep on it. And sleep on it I had. But this had booted me nothing but that endless frustrating dream about remote manipulator arms. Having slept so poorly, I didn't say much at breakfast, until I came out with, "Suppose there are no biological geometers, creatures with bodies like ours, sitting at the controls of those machines. What if they died long ago and left behind ships and probes that run an automated program?" This turned out to be an absolute conversation killer, except in the case of Saman, who seemed delighted by the idea.
"So much the better for us," he said,
which puzzled me for a moment, until I perceived that by us he meant the Eta. I considered it. "Makes you more useful to the secular power, you mean?" His face froze for a while, and I knew I had offended him.
"Perhaps being useful to them isn't the only thing we care about," he suggested. "Perhaps the Eta can have other aspirations."
"Sorry."
"Think what a fascinating problem it would be to interact with such a system," he exclaimed. I'd gotten off easy. He was so thrilled by this idea that he wasn't going to dwell on my slur. "At its lowest level, it would be a fully deterministic Syndev. But it would express itself only in certain actions, movements of the ship, transmissions of data, and so on. Observables, or we'd use givens, but go on. To grasp the workings of the syntactic program by analyzing those givens would be a sort of code-breaking effort. We Eta would have to have our own convox."
"You could solve the aboutness problem once and for all," I suggested, half serious. He lowered his gaze from enraptured study of the sky and stared at me.
"You've studied the AP?"
I shrugged. "Probably not as much as you have. We learn about it when we study the early history of the split."
"Between the followers of Sant Proc and the disciples of Sant Helicon?"
"Yeah, though it's a little unfair to call one group followers and the other disciples, if you see what I mean. Anyway, that's what we call the split."
"Procyons were more friendly to the syntactic point of view. Or maybe I should have said Fonians."
Saman seemed a little shaky here, so I reminded him, "We're speaking, remember, of aboutness? You and I can think about things. Symbols in our brains have meanings. The question is, can a syntactic device think about things or merely process digits that have no aboutness, no meaning?"
"No semantic content,"
Saman said. "Yes. Now, at the consent of Sant Mancaster, just after the reconstitution, Fawn was the FAE of the syntactic faculty, followers of Proc. She took the view that aboutness didn't exist, was an illusion that any sufficiently advanced Syndev creates for itself. By this time, Evan Edric was already dead, but he, like Helicon before him, had taken the view that our minds could do things that Syndevs couldn't, that aboutness was real,
that our thoughts really did have semantic content over and above the ones and zeros."
"Yes. It's related to the notion that our minds are capable of perceiving ideal forms in the Hylian theoric world."
"Would you people mind?"
Yul bellowed.
"We're trying to have a camp out here." "This is what we do to relax,"
Saman shot back.
"Yeah," I said. "If we were working, we'd talk about things that were tedious and complicated."
"It's worse than listening to preachers,"
Yul complained. But Ganel refused to rise to the bait.
"Let me explain it in words you can understand, cousin," Ganel said. "If the aliens are just a big computer program, Saman here can shut them down just by flipping one bit. The program won't even know it's being sabotaged."
"Only if it does not have aboutness," I cautioned him.
"If it's capable of understanding that its symbols are about something, then it'll know that Saman is up to no good."
"It would have to have crazy security measures built in,"
Yul said.
"What with all those nukes and so on?"
If it lacks aboutness, it is incredibly vulnerable, so yes, Saman said. But systems with true aboutness, or so the myth goes, should be much more difficult to deceive.
Nah,
Yul said, and looked at his cousin again.
You just have to deceive him in a different way.
Apparently the Warden of Heaven was not very convincing, Ganel pointed out. So maybe preaching isn't as easy as you think. Cord cleared her throat and frowned at her bowl.
Not that this isn't fascinating, but what is the plan today?
This produced a long silence. Cord followed up with,
I like it here, but it's beginning to feel creepy. Does anyone else think it's creepy?
You're talking to a bunch of guys, Yul said. No one here is going to validate your feelings.
She tossed sand at him. I've been doing some research, Saman said, which was creepy in itself, because I didn't understand why I should have such good reticulum access in such a godforsaken place. But you understand it now? Ganel asked. Yes, I think so.
What did you learn?
The whole island is a single parcel of private land owned by a single entity. Has been since the old Mathic Age. Back in those days it was a petty principality, got kicked back and forth between different empires from age to age. When kings and princes went out of style, it would pass into the hands of a private owner or a trust. When they came back into fashion, it'd get a prince or a baron or something again. But 900 years ago it was purchased by a private foundation. That's a thing like a dowment. And they must have had ties to the Mathic world, because the Orathena Dig, the new consent we saw yesterday, was sponsored by them.
Sponsored, or something, Saman said. A single apert, 10 days, isn't long enough to organize such a big project, I pointed out. This dowment must have been a long time making its plans.
It's not so hard, Cord said. The Unarians have apert once a year. It's easy to talk to them. Some graduate and become tenors. Some of those become hundreders, and so on. If these guys started working on it in 2800, by the time of the millennial convox of 3000, they could have had supporters everywhere except in thousander maths. I was uneasy with Cord's scenario because it sounded sneaky, but I couldn't dispute the facts she had stated. I guess what troubled me about it was that we, the Avowed, liked to believe that we were the only long-term thinkers, the only ones capable of hatching plans over centuries, and her scenario envisioned a dowment in the secular world turning the tables on us. Perhaps Saman was harboring similar feelings.
It could just as well have worked the other direction, he said.
What? I exclaimed. Are you saying that a bunch of Avowed created a dowment in the secular world to buy them an island? That's outrageous!
But we all knew Saman had won that exchange because he was relaxed, satisfied. I was angry and off balance. Largely because this all fits so neatly into what I had been told in recent weeks about the lineage. Still, everyone seemed to be looking at me for a response.
If it's like you say, Saman, then they, whoever they are, know we're here anyway. I think we should take the direct approach. Drive down there. I'll just walk up to the gate, knock, and state my business.
That got all of us on our feet, getting ready for the day, except for Ganel, who just followed Saman around.
There must be more information about what sort of entity bought the island. I mean, come on. How many things last 900 years in this world?
Lots of things, Saman said. As an example, that ark you belong to has lasted quite a bit longer.
He turned and searched Ganel's face.
That's your point, isn't it?
You think this is some kind of religious institution?
Ganel was a little taken aback and seemed to back down.
I'm just saying, businesses don't last that long.
But it's quite a stretch to go from that to saying that Ekba is run by a secret ark.
When I see Avowed walking openly in the streets of the town, Ganel said, it tells me we need to stretch beyond normal explanations.
We saw Avowed in the streets of Masht. Maybe the ones here just got evoked or something,
said Yul, getting into the act. I don't think that this seemed plausible to any of us, Yul included, but it brought us to an impasse.
Many Avowed, I said, especially Prokianfanian ones, think that belief in the Hylian theoric world is basically a religion anyway, and I have reason to believe that the Avowed down there at Orathena are the ultimate fringe of HDW believers. So whether it's a religious community or not sort of depends on how you define your terms.
I faltered as I said that last bit, just imagining how Orla would plane me if he heard me talking Sphenic gibberish. Even Saman turned to fix me with an incredulous look. But he didn't say anything because I think he understood that I was just trying to get us moving. Look, I said to Canal. Saman's investigation just got started, and we've seen before that it can take sometimes a few days for him to get access to certain things. Whether or not they open the gates for me at Orathena, you'll have plenty of time to ask around and learn more in days to come.
Yes, Ganel said. But whether they open those gates for you depends on what you say, and that depends on what you know. So maybe it's better to wait for a couple of days.
I know more than I'm saying, I said, and I want to go there today.